William Gingold, David Happ,
here.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell,
here.
Gail Kennedy,
here.
Deb Roush.
The agenda. Would anybody like to make a motion to approve? Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
I'm assuming there was no discussion about the agenda. Okay. Opposed? The agenda is approved as presented. Citizen input? Okay, we're at the citizen input stage of the agenda. Jermaine, did you have any input at this point? Okay, thank you. Okay, President's comments. I just want to, for anybody who's not up to date on respite in Illinois, DSC has just recently made application to hopefully resume state-funded respite provision. So Patty was here. Patty, what is the timeline for respite? May 17th. Hopefully, fingers crossed. Okay. Okay, great. May 17th. Executive Director's report, Lynn.
I just have two things. I kind of wanted to do an update on the ISC NOFO, which is now a lawsuit. The Belleville provider is suing. I think so. I'm not really sure if that's going to end up being just a really specific settlement. There's some talk about the state settling that, and then I believe the order to void the contracts may be lifted. Is that right? Okay. Okay. Hmm. So then, also outside of this community, I just want to let you know that it has been an interesting legislative season, both at state level and nationally. And one of the members of the Mental Health Board is going to be traveling to Washington, D.C. in May to testify on the Hill at a briefing on the Hill on the issue of young people who have developmental disabilities, and this often means they don't have a lot of services. When they have contact with justice involved, with justice, it often means they're incarcerated, even if it's really quick, and that can often mean a disruption in their Medicaid eligibility, which is costly, and then a new barrier to services. So that's, I'm really happy that she agreed to do that, and our national association is supporting getting her there to do that. It's one of the new initiatives of the National Association. They've been working on some of the problems with Medicaid, because Medicaid is interrupted at incarceration, and that is really problematic. This is a special population that probably feels it more deeply than anybody else, but because they're a small population, we haven't been lobbying too hard. So this is a really great change in the nature of that conversation at the national level. The other thing then is very close to home. We have two appointments are coming up. Two DD board appointments will be vacant as of June 30th. So I've been answering questions from prospective applicants, and that's really made me take, you know, a big step out and look at this work very broadly and appreciate how really hard this board service is, and also how hard this field can be for something that, you know, it should be pretty positive because it's supporting people to their best life. But, you know, because of the constant changes at the state level and the funding threats, it's never easy. And I'm finding that people who might be a little bit interested in this board service, you know, when we start talking about what it really looks like, kind of say, oh, I don't know now. So that has made me really appreciate even more than ever all of the effort that the agencies put into these applications. This process is not easy. It happens very quickly. We changed it a lot this year. I think we are trying to be more responsive to input and keep changing it until it's working better for everybody. So all of the agencies which completed successful, you know, which completed applications, really were hanging in there with us. And I really appreciate that so much. And as we go through the review of the applications, we also reflect on the process a lot. So this is a great time for us to think about what we ought to change the next time around, or what we can change in the contracting relationships to make things better. I think this community is very lucky to have so many people who are willing to do this work that is often hard and not as rewarding as it should be for something with such a wonderful and inspiring mission. Anyway, that's it.
Okay, thank you, Lynn. The CCDDB board meeting and study session minutes, two different meetings, from March 20th, 2019 and March 27th, 2019. They're included in the packet beginning on page 3. I'd like to make a motion to approve those minutes as presented. Discussion? All in favor? Aye. Opposed? Okay, the minutes for both meetings are approved as presented. Financial information, which is the claims report, is included in the packet on pages 9 to 10. I'd like to make a motion also to approve the claims report as presented. Discussion? All in favor? Aye. Opposed? Claims report is approved as presented. New business. Beginning on page 11, all the way through page 111, are our agency requests for IDD funding for fiscal year 2020. Also included with those applications is the cover sheet summary of the cultural and linguistic competence activities per agency, and draft program summaries and a list of acronyms. There was a lot of input about every application this year from staff. There were questions raised by staff, questions raised by board members, and also there was an independent evaluator who weighed in with questions as every application was reviewed. So you'll see that there are quite a few reviewer comments and questions in each application, and so we have a lot of things to talk about. But thank you all.
On the first page of this section of this agenda item is a spreadsheet, and we've tried, you know, it lists all the applications by priority, which is something we started doing last year, and that's just seems to be a helpful way for us to organize the discussion. But we did make a mistake in this one. Developmental Services Center Connections should not be under Employment Services and Supports. It should be under Non-Work Community Life and Flexible Support. So even though we'll discuss it in order today, we've moved it for the next level discussion. Sorry about that.
I was working off my draft anyway.
So, just starting off, I'm wondering if, since we have a cultural and linguistic competency summary that is at this is the first page of each first application by an agency. Does that make sense? That's right. If we had any discussions or questions about the CLC summary plans as a whole, or Chandra, if you had any comments about the process or the questions. Or the plans, pardon me.
I just wanted to let you know that instead of just reviewing the plan only, I read all of the program plans under each application. So what you'll see are not necessarily comments only about the plan, because there may have not been some things that were even included in the plan that were required, but because they were included in the application, I made sure that I noted that they talked about those CLC okay. values and principles in okay. the plan, in the application, as well as the plan.
That's pretty much in your additional comments section at the bottom
correct.
Of each one, correct? Okay.
Or it was noted in the actual chart. Okay. I may have said, like, it was included in program plan one.
Okay. Thank
okay.
you.
Mm-hmm.
So we are beginning with linkage and advocacy for people with IDD, correct? Mm-hmm. And the first application was made by CCRPC Community Services. So we invite you to come on up and talk about it. Maybe typically don't we just do a very brief summary of the application, what the program is intended to do? Just to orient everybody, and then we can begin with questions. Okay.
Hi, good morning. So essentially our application this year, we are proposing to expand our person-centered planning services that we've offered this past year with one full-time staff working with DSC's Community First program to do person-centered planning for between 40 and 50 individuals. So in this application, we're proposing to expand that to 200 people who are getting services through the various funded programs of the CCDDB. So that would be hiring four new full-time staff to do that work with an average of a caseload of 40 or so, equal about 200 clients getting services through DDB-funded services. And then we're continuing, as we have in the last few years, with our transition consultant services. So we have two part-time transition consultants working primarily closely with the schools in Champaign County to do transition planning. They've been meeting with families before IEPs, attending IEPs with families to help advocate, and then doing some case management, identifying a goal plan of things that they want to work on with the families, and then follow up accordingly based on what their needs are. And then also continuing with case management and preference assessment work that we've been doing continuously funded through this program.
I just have one question quickly about transition planning. You know, per the school code and our DDB statute, the school has to take the lead in that transition planning, and that remains the case. Is that correct?
That is correct.
The school districts are doing those transition plans, and you're there in a supportive role.
Absolutely. And then our transition consultants also do. We have our kind of own goal planning sheet that we've identified that they also do with all families. So they request a copy of the IEP and then sit down with families to go over that, see if they have any questions, and then internally working with our transition consultants to develop a goal plan related to that. It's a bit more focused, not quite as some families we're finding are very confused by the wording in the IEP. They're not, it's kind of overwhelming, so we're trying to break it down to more, I guess, short, actionable goals that they want, that we can support them with in the time that they're getting services through with our transition consultants.
Another question about the whole person-centered plan process. It's a global understanding of the person's preferences that goes in scope well beyond long-term housing supports or employment, vocational. Mm-hmm. We're looking at interests, hobbies, rec, leisure preferences, all of that. And it seems like, I'm just kind of wondering how far it goes in helping link individuals and their families with supports and services other than employment, housing, you know, so that we have, you know, it seems we do a lot of planning now and a lot of preference assessment. To what end, though? Is there a way that we can help people more than by just giving them a phone number for horse therapy or those types of activities?
Absolutely. Through the discovery process, I mean, it's really quite comprehensive. And so we're finding, even with some families, the services and linkage that we're providing is even beyond DD services. Maybe the family is low income and they need linkage just to, you know, SNAP benefits or, you know, any sort of assistance just within kind of their household that would also benefit every single person in that household. So the scope is, the scope can be beyond DD services. And so what we really do as part of the discovery process is identify what the needs are. And yes, sometimes it's related to employment or independent living, things like that. But we're finding that it's going beyond that. And so we've developed kind of a resource list that's pretty comprehensive that we provide to families. Our transition consultants actually took the lead on developing that. And so we use that. We also take advantage of 211. And then we use resources that were identified and put together by the Transition Planning Committee to provide to families. So we kind of use all three of those areas. And that can mean different things. I noticed one of the questions in the application was, is that providing a phone number? Is that providing, you know, a piece of paper? It really depends. Some, we've sat down with people and have made contacts, for example, maybe to Parkland with them. We can go with them to Parkland if they wanted to. It just depends on what they prefer. Some people are comfortable and just want a simple contact information, and that's it, and that's fine. So it's pretty individualized.
I have a question. Obviously, it's relatively easy to understand. Or me, the adult services side, what are you doing with these very young children that I see you serving? There's a 0 to 6, age 6, one person, and 7 to 12, 6 people.
So the young children that have been served through the program are, let me think about this. I believe those are normally referrals that are coming, that we're doing additional support with the family when they're registering on PUNS. So when we do that preference assessment, at that time, the case manager is identifying if they need additional support. And so we're really working with the family to provide additional case management and follow-up services. But it is few and far between, but it's normally with parents, yes.
Just one more question for me.
Under your first outcome, it says there's a target or benchmark level for program services down at the bottom of, near the bottom of page, what would be 15. Outcome number one, for person-centered planning services, all persons served are required to have at least one outcome. Could you explain that?
Sure. So that's actually in line with the state DHS requirements, and so we're trying to mirror that as much as possible in person-centered planning. So even if it's a maintenance outcome that someone has already been working on, they have to have at least one goal that they want to be working on over the next year. If that's, again, to maintain their employment, a maintenance goal is absolutely fine, but there does need to be at least one outcome or goal in the plan.
Mm-hmm. No other questions? Okay. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, next up, DSC program is service coordination.
Good morning.
Could you very briefly, well, first identify yourself and then very briefly just describe this application, but, you know, just the nuts and bolts of this program.
So I'm Ron Rubriesco. I'm the Director of Case Management for Developmental Services Center. My idea of case management in how DSC supports individuals is I guess, a more on the ground day-to-day case management. While there are, you know, there is the person-centered planning process that we collaborate with the ISC organization. That's a part of a person's life and how we plan. But then there's the day-to-day that is really important to us, and we see it based on the individual as opposed to we support families, but most of our folks are individuals living in the community or in CILAs, and their needs vary greatly. We have folks who work in the community and who just need support in financial planning, or we are the representative payee for more than 100 individuals. They're not deemed eligible to handle their own funds by Social Security, so we have been asked, and we continue to provide that support. Housing, medical appointments, as again, on the ground every day, what our folks need to survive in the community and become more a part of the community with each passing year in their life. That we see a lot of growth. The more we assist people in getting in the community, the more successes we see. The family support for individuals can vary from very involved, who attend every meeting we have, who see and speak to their son or daughter frequently, to folks who have no support whatsoever. And we are the ones they turn to when they have an issue with their housing, their roommate, neighbors, landlords, anything you can think of. Some find their way into legal issues that they need support with. Some want to be become independent and not have a guardian. We help them through that process. Anything else that you can possibly think of that a person, any individual, your son or daughter, could find in the community, positive or negative, we tend to be involved in. And it's very hands-on. We know our individuals really well. They depend on us. They want to be in contact with us. And we get to know them over the years and get to know their extended families if they're involved.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear you say that your focus is with direct kind of intensive service delivery rather than the planning and preparation for services, because to me that role is something that our gatekeeper, the RPC, is involved in. And then you're saying basically that you take those plans and the preparation that they've done in through the person-centered planning process and actually are able then to provide the actual direct services that the individuals need with this money.
Yes, both aspects are really important, but I think you kind of hit it on the head. Their function at ISC is more planning, and ours is more implementation of those plans and direct support. We work really well with the ISC organization, and in a recent case, there was a family struggling, a mom and two kids. We're very happy to get that referral from the ISC representative, but then at that point, we took it from there. The individual was, her funds were being accessed by her family, who she was living with, and it wasn't necessarily going to her benefit. So she asked that we take over her Social Security payship. I filled out the form to change payship and delivered that to Social Security. Another staff person was assigned to help utilize their home-based support funds and get them help in the home, and we took it from there, and again, to the nuts and bolts on-the-ground support.
Any other questions for Ron?
So this is not just for you, Ron. This is for all of the DSC applications. At some point, I think DSC needs to tell us how they're dealing with the deficit, because that deficit is substantial, and in some cases, the deficit is large. This one is small. It's only $3,000. But I think that in order to make sure that we don't have programs that are in significant trouble, we need to know what's going on.
I guess we should let everybody know, too, that in addition to questions that might, we have one board member missing today, and questions that are posed today are not the have all and end all of questions. We will have more questions for you, and if you've talked at all with any of the agencies about this, Lynn, about the questions that arise today that we may think about later, or Dr. Gingold's not here and was supposed to maybe have prepared some questions. I'm not sure if he got them in on time. He did not. So he will probably have questions. So we'd like to be able to present questions to you all. I think we did this last year with a turnaround time of about May 1st to get any additional questions answered so that we can consider that input when we make our decisions. Okay. Thank you. One more question, Ron. There was a reviewer comment here about outreach and engagement to underserved minority population, and it was pretty, I guess, unclear that it's clear that there is some, but just that they are served. About 17% of those served are from rural areas. Are you seeing improvement in this particular program in getting the word out and getting help and assistance in rural areas?
My sense is yes, it is year to year, it's increasing. As to case management and how we become involved, it's usually by a referral from if Annette in the vocational program or the job placement program want to bring someone in who they've had a referral, then we become involved. We're kind of not the primary, there are very few people who call just for case management. The case I described to you was just for case management, but that's, it's somewhat rare. Usually it's through a day program, through home-based support award being given to a family. Then we become involved, but often it's through job placement or day program or residential. Someone moving into an apartment, then we're always a component of that team.
Any other questions for Ron? Okay, thank you, Ron. Next up is Rosecrans, Coordination of Services for DDMI, Dual Diagnosis.
Hi, I'm Kathy Kessler, and I'm the Community Support Supervisor at Rosecrans over our case management services that we provide. We've had this program for a number of years. It's a small program. We serve probably around 30 to 35 people a year. The program is geared to work with individuals who have a dual diagnosis of a mental illness and a developmental disability. There was a need that was identified a number of years ago that there was a gap in providing services for individuals with both of these diagnoses. So application was made and funding was received through this board. The program basically serves, we provide a lot of linkages and advocacy for the clients in which we get our referrals from a number of different agencies, ISC, DSC, Community Connections, PACE. We get additional referrals that come through our access department at Rosecrans to work with individuals that have this dual diagnosis. We assess their needs. The case manager that's in charge of this program completes the mental health assessment, which identifies what their particular needs are. We create a treatment plan around those individualized needs and work with the individual in improving whatever needs were identified. She provides the warranted mental health services that are required. She coordinates a great deal of her time spent coordinating with a lot of different agencies in regard to the client and making sure the clients are getting the services that they need, that they're getting linked to those services that they need. She's kind of like Ron was talking about, is hands-on, goes with the clients to make sure, to assure that they get linked to the services that they need. She continues to follow up with the providers to find out that they're getting the services that they need. Many of the clients in this program have a chronic mental illness. So in addition to the chronic mental illness and their cognitive impairment, they may be in this program a lot longer than some of our regular case management clients, you know, that we're able to work with on goals and objectives and move them on more quickly. This particular population takes a lot. You have to work at a slower pace with them because of that. An additional thing that has happened in the last 6 months is Christina created a drum circle group, which has been very, very successful. This is a evidence-based research program that basically works with individuals in working on in building their coping skills, concentration skills, helps them build on their focus, helps them interact with other individuals in the group. We've purchased a number of different types of drums, from very small drums to very large drums, and there's even this thing that's called a frog that they kind of go back and forth on. And so this has been in existence for about 6 months. The clients really, really enjoy this group. They were even asked to entertain at the disability fair, which they did. There was about six of them that took part in the disability fair. The entertainment part and two staff, and the clients were so excited afterwards that now they've said, well, when can we do this again? You know, it's kind of like that. Now they want to take it on the road. So we're exploring different avenues of what we can do to kind of continue this on. I think that kind of is an overview in a nutshell.
Thank you. Okay. Questions?
I was really interested in the drum circle, and I was thinking about the School of Music. Has there been any overtures to them to get music students out to also work with your folks?
No, but that's an excellent idea.
Okay, because I do think that, and if they don't want it, please contact the College of Applied Health Sciences, because our community health students might be interested too.
Okay.
I just have one question about who develops the person-centered plans for these individuals.
The client and Christina, or Christine, and many times families are involved in it too.
Okay.
I have one more, sorry. How are you guys dealing with the deficit that you're running?
How are we dealing with the deficit?
We have multiple programs that are in deficit.
Right.
We have not just this program,
right.
But we have money to support us continuing to go forward. So.
Okay, so I think that having, again, like I said with DSC, having an explanation of how you'll deal with the deficit is a good idea, so that we know that you guys aren't in serious trouble.
Thank you, ladies. Okay, next up, community choices, customized employment.
Hi, I'm Becca Obachowski with Community Choices. So our customized employment program really focuses on finding people community-based employment for the vast majority of folks. That's going to be paid employment that's based on their skills and interests. So we use a customized model that starts with a discovery process, where we spend 4 to 6 weeks getting to know the individual, getting a sense of kind of what their skills, what their interests are, what type of employment, what type of job, what type of duties are going to be of interest to them, what type of environments they're most comfortable with, sort of where they're at in terms of kind of managing all of the other sort of life elements that go into having a successful employment. So that might be transportation, that might be sort of coordinating with the family, looking at what other types of kind of like background supports might exist for that individual. And then identifying usually about three employment themes at the end of that discovery process that could be it could be a particular skill the person has. It could be a particular area of interest, a particular line of work. It's very broad. And then we bring the team together to sort of discuss what those themes are, and do some sort of collaborative brainstorming about what are the type of jobs, what are the type of connections that people might have within that person's life, that person may have themselves, that are going to be good kind of leads to follow in order to find employment. From there, we sort of meet with that person usually once or twice a week to sort of follow up on leads, to apply for jobs, to tour different businesses if they're kind of not quite sure or not they don't if they don't have a lot of experience with a particular type of job that we think might be a good fit for them. We'll kind of go and take a look at it to see if they feel comfortable with something like that, and then. Ideally they'll be getting interviews, we'll support them in that process. And then finally once they find a job, we do job coaching for that position, making sure that they have the tools and that they understand their role, that they're building good relationships with their supervisor and with other people who their coworkers, sort of identifying some of the natural supports on the job so that as they get more comfortable, we our staff can fade back and really kind of have that good, solid relationship between the individual and their employer. And then we do continue to provide ongoing support. It's very individualized. For some people, that on-the-job support lasts longer. For some people, if they're feeling really good about it, it might be shorter. But we do continue to check in, every couple weeks, every month, as the person has been at their job longer, the length of time between those check-ins kind of extends. But we're always, up to about 18 months or so, where we're available if the person has questions. Invariably, managers change. They may get some new responsibilities, and we're available to kind of come back in, do some retraining, kind of, make connections with that new employer so that they feel like there's kind of that. We have like that sort of liaison role with the person and their employer, so they kind of got a partner in it. And ideally those employment relationships kind of continue. So that's the overall sort of picture of what our employment department looks like. We also offer a job club for people who are waiting for support or who are maybe in that sort of job development process, maybe haven't found a role yet or just looking for some additional support with some of the soft skills involved in employment. So we focus on things like professionalism, communication, you know, how to take on leadership roles and kind of be a good, you know, team player within the employment setting, sort of in a more general sense. And those meet about twice a month.
Questions?
So, Becca?
Yes.
All of your folks cease to have ongoing job coaching at about 18 months?
That's correct, for the most part. For some people who have higher support needs, they may have other supports that exist in their life, and so we will do some coordination with those supports if it is somebody who needs that, you know, one-on-one support on an ongoing basis. So we, our department is relatively small, so to be able to support the number of people finding new employment, we are not able to provide continual sort of ongoing one-on-one support, but we will work with that individual to identify what those supports may be. And we've actually found that we've had a number of people kind of come to us and say, we're really going to need somebody there 100% of the time, ongoing forever. and it's really remarkable to see that when you, you know, when you put the expectation that, like, this person can be independent, and if we can set up some of the additional supports kind of surrounding the person, that a lot of times we find that both the individual, the employer, and their family or their support team are actually much more comfortable with us backing away, you know, as they kind of ease into, you know, a lot of times it's a new employment, maybe a new experience for them, or a sort of a something that they're building or growing into. But, yeah.
So who do you hand them off to if at 18 months they still need greater services?
It depends. For folks who have home-based support, a lot of times we will work with the family to identify and hire and train a PSW.
Okay.
Who is able to come in. There's a few families who are able to private pay. You know, we have one or two families that do have the capacity for that. And then for a lot of other folks, we do find that we haven't needed to find some sort of additional support. But you know, we could look into different options for that if it were to come up.
Okay, because this sounds, it's been 30 years since I job coached, so
sure.
Sorry.
No.
It kind of surprises me that you've got that kind of independence at 18 by 18 months. The other thing that I remember, and I, in keeping up with the literature, a lot of people lose their jobs. The placements are effective to start with, and then they find out that they don't really want to do the job they're doing. When they start faltering in the job and you can see that it's not a good match, do you guys automatically look for a new placement, or do you rethink your assessment, or what do you do?
I think the broader answer would probably be, it kind of depends on the individual, but in general, we will work with the person to, if it looks like they really don't want that job anymore and it's not a good fit for whatever reason, we always try to make sure that we're supporting the person to leave that position on the best possible terms, so that they can have, you know, maintain a pretty good work history and be able to, you know, to say employers, you know, it just wasn't a good fit when they're finding a new job. And I think at that point, we're happy to help a person identify a new position. Sometimes we'll sit down with the family. You know, we've had people who say, you know what, employment, we weren't there. We're going to focus on other things from time to time. And sometimes it is just a question of, like, I was bored, or I found out that, you know, this particular type of work, I thought I liked it and I didn't. And so, you know, sometimes it's just been not a very supportive environment, and so it's not actually the work, it's just the environment. And so in those cases, we may look for a position that's maybe similar but with a different employer. But for times when it's been somebody who kind of was like, I actually need to reassess myself what I'm interested in, we will go through that discovery process again. So it's really on a case-by-case basis. And in those instances, we usually sit down with the person and their family or their support team and say, like, kind of like, where are we at? What do you guys want to do? You know, what seems like it's going to work out best for you?
Thank you, Becca.
Yep.
Next is DSC's community employment.
Good morning, Annette Becker, Director of Employment Services.
And I actually have community employment connections and employment first, so I don't like to get up and down. So our employment services program is the process for helping people find jobs is very similar to what Becca just described, so I won't go through that process again. I think one of the things that sets us apart a little bit is that we historically have supported people with more complex support needs. And so sometimes our discovery process and the actual job development process is longer. We've had people who are in job development for a year, which seems very extreme. But to that one person, finding the right match is very important. And so we make that commitment to do so. We also provide unlimited job coaching for people who need it. And what we found is that that has helped people be successful long term. A DRS counselor about a year ago shared with me that he had done an audit of a Department of Rehabilitation Services, and they're the state funding source for people finding jobs. And he had done an audit of people who had found jobs through them for the past 10 years. And people supported by DSC had the highest job retention rate, the highest percentage of increases in pay, and increases in responsibility. So, you know, the ongoing support beyond just that initial transition phase is really important. The other thing that we found is that some businesses have, you know, said we really appreciate the ongoing job coaching. We've been approached by employers who have asked us to come in and provide job coaching, even though we were not the, we didn't help that person find a job. So it is individual. We have some people that were backing out very quickly, and other people that, quite honestly, if we weren't providing ongoing job coaching, the employer would not continue that person's employment. So it is kind of mixed. I think that's it, if you have any questions.
How many people are able to participate in the paid experience through Carle Services? Is it a one at a time?
We're really excited about that. It's really opened a lot of interest from people within our in-home or our in-house employment programs. It really depends on the people that we are supporting up there. Right now we have 1 to 2 people, and it varies depending on the level of support that each person needs, and then also the availability or the work that's needed by Carle Hospital. And Carle has been amazing. They have just really been so open to providing opportunities. What we've found with that also is that people are actually, the people that work at Clark Road are now asking if they can go work at Carle. There's been that much excitement from the people who are doing it, and it seems to be a very kind of safe environment for them to kind of, you know, get their feet wet a little bit in employment.
So this is not so much a question as, there's a lot of work being done around using high tech to help maintain people, to keep them in their employment situations. I would encourage you to keep an eye on the literature, because I think that's going to explode in the next couple of years, especially when you're looking at doing highly technical things. It's amazing what WOW Tech has pushed things forward.
We actually, through, and this is a different application, but through the Employment First grant, we did a family meeting on technology. It is amazing what's out there. I wish it had been around 30 years ago.
Are we ready to move on to the next? which is Connections, right?
Connections. So Connections is really a location and a staff position. It's really kind of hard to talk about the applications that I oversee individually because they're really all connected to getting people connected to the community and to employment. And so they're all kind of cogs in the same wheel. What we use Connections for, we have classes and activities and events. And the way we differentiate between those, the art classes, people actually learned about the different kinds of art and then have been able to show that and sell that. Some of the groups are more about just having experiential opportunities. One example is an upcycling group. They're really interested in recycling things that might otherwise be thrown away, and they've made clocks and I can't think of some of the other cool. They made little Zen gardens, but they basically use recycled materials. So that's not really a class, that's more of an activity. And then the events would be things like Ebert Fest, where they may actually made the product down at the Crow, Boneyard Arts Festival, etc. We have worked with, it's also a place for the Enactus group. We had three people who wanted to start their own business, and so they did use that space as well. We're also we've kind of switched from looking at it as a storefront that's open continuously every day. We just found that the management of that was pretty difficult. We just finished working with the Geese School of Business, and they have helped us develop a plan to do a pop-up store. We'll start with one weekend per month. We'll open that up to other vendors. They helped us identify vendors. They helped us identify really what product would be most popular and most profitable. So we're moving forward with that also.
So Annette, about how many hours per week is the storefront, the Crow, in use?
An actual store or the space in particular?
Well, the space in particular, but as a store too.
We really have not used it as a store to this point.
Okay. Do you see that you'd be able to do that down the road? You know, just to try to make that space more inclusive. You
yes,
know,
definitely.
Less of a segregated and more mm-hmm. of an included setting. You know.
Yes. The hard part is really coming up with a management plan that's sustainable until the business would get off the ground. But we worked with the Geese School of Business, and they really felt this was kind of a better direction to start out.
Questions? It seems like this could. Have you worked with any of the art students at the university, the various art departments? Because there is a question a reviewer posed at the bottom of page 40 regarding leveraging the talents of local artists.
Yeah, you know, we have tried to do that, and one of the real struggles with that is just staff time. We've had, actually through our connections with Boneyard, we had a photographer who wanted to kind of swap being able to use that space as for a show with teaching a photography class, and then her mother became ill, and so that was kind of dropped, and we haven't been able to pick that up yet, although she's been involved with DSC and other things. We have another man that we're trying to work with. He does wire art, and we're working with him to swap coming in and teaching that, or actually what we would do, we would have maybe two or three spaces in his class, and then we would allow him to use that space to do a class, and it's just kind of like trying to keep that rolling.
A class other than with your individuals.
Correct. He would just offer the class, and we would be able to reserve two or three spots in that class for people that we support who would be interested. And then we would have a staff person supporting them if needed.
Okay. All right. That'd be great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Employment First.
All right. Employment First. Again, it kind of fits in with the first two. So this is really the outreach to businesses, the outreach to families, and also staff development. And this program really continues to evolve. Initially, it was really just about getting businesses in, getting them, you know, kind of on board with the concept of employing people with disabilities. And now we're taking it a step further. We're getting employers involved in working with other employers. So we're still doing the new trainings. We had a focus group of employers who kind of talked about their process and how other employers can be involved. We also have recently started working on doing training for frontline staff because they're the people really who are out there being the natural supports. We're actually meeting on Monday to kind of finalize which businesses will kind of help us look at that frontline training that's been developed and see if they think it would be helpful, and then we'll be ready to launch that. We also have a quarterly newsletter that goes out to all employers who have participated in LEAP training, and it's got everything from comments made by other employers or people who have gotten jobs. There's a corner that talks about the job coach's corner that kind of talks about maybe some accommodations that would be easy to make. So it's just kind of a little quick read for employers to be able to access. And then I'm missing something. Yeah. Success stories, those kind of things. And I know one of the questions was, or comments was about 15 businesses being certified. Actually, we just finished pulling the information together for the third quarter, and we had 23 or 24 just this quarter. And it ebbs and flows. You know, during the second quarter, businesses are kind of amping up for the holidays. We really don't get much interest. You know, so this quarter, usually things are a little bit slower for businesses. And so we do tend to see more this quarter. But 24 was quite a bit.
Pardon me? Oh, excellent. We're certified now also, right? Okay.
Yes,
good.
That's right.
Good.
And I heard that was the best training we've ever had.
Oh. I know that this program's about culture shift, you know, that we've been, but, you know, as a board, we talk about how can we begin to think about more robust ways, like paid internships, you know, just rolling around different ideas about how we can actually get people employed.
Yeah, that we talk about that. You know, we're seeing... you know, I think with the culture change, we expected it to take some time. And, you know, we've tried to evaluate, well, how many businesses actually hire people? Sometimes we don't know. We find out after the fact. And we're trying to keep track with the businesses who maintain contact with us. And we do a month follow-up and then three-month follow-ups. You know, sometimes when we really focus on the smaller businesses, it may be some time before, you know, if they only have 10 employees, it may be some time before they really have the capacity to add a person. But we do see more of those small businesses hiring people. We have more businesses who are reaching out to us to be LEAP certified, and I think that's pretty huge too. And we're seeing a bigger increase in the number of businesses who want to continue to be part of this process. you know, being part of the focus groups, you know, being willing to talk to other businesses who aren't sure about hiring somebody with a disability. It's like, yeah, give them my phone number. I would be happy to talk to them. So, you know, I think we're seeing it in that, in those ways.
Any other questions for Annette? Thank you. Okay, next up, United Cerebral Palsy. Vocational Services. Yes, nobody's here to represent today, so we'll move on. Thank you. DSC, Apartment Services.
Good morning, Sarah Perry, Director of Residential Services at DSC. The Apartment Services Program provides supports to individuals so they can continue to live independently, whether it's in their home, in their apartment, or at our supported apartment building. Our case managers assist individuals with learning and maintaining skills. We provide long-term and ongoing supports, especially with the skill areas that our individuals are unable to master. And these supports definitely ebb and flow based on the individual's needs, especially now we're noticing as the individual's age and health deterioration takes place, and any other impacts that may cause their skill level to decrease or even increase. Some of the services that we provide include financial, independent living, community integration, and a lot of medical support. So with regards to financial, a lot of times we are rep payees. We assist in paying bills. We assist with balancing the checkbooks, budgeting, going over banking processes and going to the bank with them. Independent living includes a range of skills, cooking, cleaning, hygiene, grooming, grocery shopping, any dietary needs that we need to address. Community integration is a wide span with social activities, being involved in the community, hobby exploration, learning to ride the MTD bus so they can access all of these activities, as well as securing housing and assisting with any change that they might want to make with different housing and assisting them with moving. And then medical supports has become a large factor. Again, as the population ages, we attend, schedule all dental, vision, and medical appointments. Then we collaborate with the team at DSC in regards to their health status. Again, we respond to any chronic and especially acute health issues that are needed for them to continue living independently. The training takes place in the community or at their residence. So they rarely come to DSC to meet with individuals. This is all community-based. So the case managers in this program are in the office limited time. They are out and about in the community most of their days. And something that we've started looking into that I think is pretty spectacular is starting to see the need to bridge some skills from individuals that are still living at home with parents but have a desire to move out into the community on their own. So we're starting to assess and push into some homes and do some skills training at the parents' home, and then we'll hopefully develop some groups based on their needs and then push towards them getting some community living on their own with additional apartment services supports.
I have one question that came from another reviewer's comment here that I never really truthfully thought about before, and that is that you're staff is working with the individuals in apartment services during daytime hours, a typical, what, 8 to 4:30 mm-hmm. time frame, when you would think that these individuals would be involved in some other type of either community-based or not necessarily community-based activities. Is there, you know, how often does it occur that you're actually taking somebody to do banking or some other type of activity that's to build life skills from employment or some other type of vocational or volunteer activity that they're participating in during the day? To me, the ability to maybe do some of those things after hours like typical people do and maintain their activities during the day is really important toward building a fuller life.
Sure. Well, we definitely arrange the schedule for our services based on those activities. And most of our individuals aren't working or volunteering full time. So the times that they are not involved in that, then we push in with the independent living skills. We have to be very conscientious of the banking hours, of course, as well as the medical needs. You know, the clinics are only open during the day, so most of those activities have to happen between the 8 to 5. However, we do fluctuate our hours based on the individual's needs. You know, we had a recent situation where we were spending Monday through Sunday until 10 p.m. in the evening to make sure this individual received the supports they needed. So it is very individually based. Typical schedule is the 8 to 5, Monday through Friday. However, we do accommodate as needed. Oh, yeah, and the pager as well. We do have a rotation with the apartment services staff that they do have to be on call. So there is always somebody on call from 10 p.m. I'm sorry, 5 p.m. to 8 a.m. So all of the after hours are covered. If anybody has an emergency, apartment services as well as the clinical coordinator share the pager and we'll get a response.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else have questions?
I had one. It looks like that there's a very stable long-term population of people that you're serving here. What is the ability for new people to get into this program? What is that limited by?
Sure. Patty's going to speak to that.
Hi there. I think that, one, we have an apartment building that has 24 units in it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, based on people's level of independence there, and sometimes that's a step forward and sometimes it's a step back. That creates opportunities for people that are seeking that kind of service. The waiting list for apartment services kind of ebbs and flows too. We've seen at times when we've had a vacancy or we've had capacity to serve some and people aren't ready. But then we've also had the experience where there's several people waiting, and when the opportunity exists, then you know there isn't enough capacity to support all those needs. One of the things that is going to, I think, help with that independence and the readiness is going into the family home, and I can think of at least one instance that we'll be doing soon in one of our CILAs in the group home where we think somebody is close to being ready to live on their own, to kind of set up that relationship and establish, you know, the skill set and stuff that they need so that when that opportunity exists, we'd be ready and so would they. I also think that there are some people, depending on whether they have home-based support or what kind of skill level they have, if they don't need that apartment building and they can go straight into an apartment in the community, then it's more about housing availability and affordable housing. But we are able to support people outside that apartment building. I think about half the program are people that live in their own apartment or home.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And then I was just going to speak kind of more globally. There was a comment made earlier about the deficit. That obviously is going to be something that gets covered in the written response because that's been kind of a theme throughout the applications. And we obviously know that's something we need to respond to, not just to you, but internally. So we will be addressing that along with all the other questions by the May 1st deadline. Okay. Thank you.
Anybody have any more questions for either? Thank you. Next is DSC Clinical Services. Welcome back, Ron.
I'm back. Our clinical services program was developed years ago by a former employee near and dear to us, Lynn, and it supports individuals who might need counseling or psychiatry intervention, and also helps us with psychological evaluations for individuals who are new to the agency. They can also help with problem solving. I find this to be extremely helpful. It is important to our SILA program. We have several people who see our psychiatrists out of that program and work programs. It's across the agency. Our counselors, many of them give us a discount. They might charge $120 an hour in the community, but they charge us $80. Recently, in the past year, it was kind of nice to know that some of our services are spread by word of mouth. We had a mother who contacted us, and her daughter, and she had lost their father and husband. And the daughter was very close to her dad, and she wanted some short-term counseling. We were able to do that. We're not always able to immediately address needs, but we try whenever possible. And within 6 months or so, we got another call from a mother who had lost her son, and her daughter was very distraught about that. And she had heard about the counseling through the first mother. And it's the significance of, I feel the significance of our program is that we, from the start, have sought to engage clinicians who have experience with people with developmental disabilities. I find that incredibly important, and we've had some folks who actually worked at DSC in a day program before they went to college, and then went to social work school, became licensed clinical social workers, and came back and worked for several years providing counseling to our individuals. Others have had siblings who had developmental disabilities and who had, through one way or another in their life, found connections with people with developmental disabilities. So that, I think, is the most important part, is that we're not just seeking counseling from anyone who has availability, but for someone who actually has a background. And for me, that's the same thing I would do for my son when he was younger. I don't want to pick just any doctor or any clinician. I want the best for my son in the past, and I also want the best for our individuals we serve.
There's a question posed by a reviewer, not my question, but I'm going to ask it anyway because it seems interesting to me. The reviewer has stated that given that the psychiatrist under contract is the clinical director for a medical provider which bills insurance, it would seem that eligible individuals should be seen there rather than through the DSC subcontract?
He is engaged with us as an independent contractor. They really don't have the capacity to serve as many folks as we present to them. He comes to our agency twice a month and for a couple, 2 to 3 hours per session, and it really doesn't have anything to do with his job as clinical coordinator or director for the pavilion. Okay. He is able to do that through his contract at Pavilion to have that much time off. And we're extremely fortunate. It took us, psychiatry in this town is very difficult to find.
It is.
And at Carl, if you are referred, it can take up to 6 months or longer to see a psychiatrist. Dr. Repetto is, I was thinking about this last night, and I remember us really getting desperate, and we had reached out to him, and he didn't respond for a couple of weeks, I think, and we finally got a letter. In our first meeting, I had never met him before, and we just heard through families who had had his service at Pavilion, and we talked about how we would structure his practice at DSC and other incidentals. And at the end of the conversation, he said, I want to do this. Let's have fun with this. And he is an upbeat person. He has fun with the staff. He really cares for the individuals. He's flexible in how he supports them. Some of our folks aren't really real positive when it comes to seeing a doctor of any kind. And he will go and meet with them wherever they are in the agency, or if they're in a day program, he'll go sit down with them there instead of making them come to a room and sit in this quiet room with a few staff people. So, and he includes that individual's team when necessary to make sure he has appropriate feedback and so he can provide the best treatment possible.
Okay. Given that I'm very familiar with all those innovations, I think the issue is not so much where the service is taking place, but if there is another payer, that's in all of the contracts, that other payers need to be used first. So you mentioned this being very valuable to people in Scylla, who by definition have other coverage for this type of service, whether the Pavilion would cover it or not, I don't know. You also mentioned people who learned about grief counseling through word of mouth who may themselves have other insurance. So this program could be, it's not clear from your answers whether this program is paying for the services directly or if it's paying to refer people to these highly regarded clinicians who seem to be able to work with this population in a much more appropriate way. So, or if this money is being used for the referrals and also access to community-based providers who can bill insurance for the services themselves. It would seem like that's a transition, or that's an effort we've talked about for many years, and there's a big difference, you know, paying for the services with DDB dollars may represent a pretty big conflict because that's people pay for the tax. People pay for public insurance already, and I mean, so it's sort of taxing Champaign County twice for the same thing.
Hi, I'm Heather Levingston, and I am the clinical coordinator right now at DSC. And to answer your question, we do push accessing other alternatives as much as possible first. We have had a few go over to Promise to receive counseling. Rosecrans, Family Services. It's more when they can't find an alternative or the wait list for psychiatry might be 9 months to a year, and then we're maybe able to see them or even still trying to put them on that list that they can eventually move over to that option.
So people would be on a waiting list for services which could be billed to another payer, but you're able to serve them while they're on the waiting list. How often do you have people successfully, you know, reach the goal in that scenario?
With psychiatry, I think we've had like two. Counseling, we've really been fortunate to push most referrals. I know the last quarter, I think I had five. End up in other alternatives, four or five.
That still seems like a really gray area to me, I have to say, considering the board as and board dollars as being payor of last resort, because typically it's not just individuals who are being served. everybody has a psychiatry is such a difficult find for everybody, you know. So, yeah, something I have to think about a little bit more. But yeah, there is a very gray area here.
We do have several individuals who see psychiatrists at Carl or other places because they've been fortunate enough to get in or waited until the time had come for them to come up on the waiting list. So there's probably as many or close to as many people who see our psychiatrists who have outside services for those kind of medications. And sometimes it's the primary physician.
So does this program still have a role in the coordination to those providers? Because I know a little bit about what you do in that role as far as preparing information for providers, which would be very difficult for them to get in a 6 to 15 minute session. Do you provide that service through this contract to, say, psychiatrists at Carl?
I think most times it would be other team members that would have that information that would, if they would come to me, then I would usually reach out to the case coordinator or other team members that would know them better that would be able to gather that information to pass on to the psychiatry.
And we also have individuals who are very sensitive to medications due to neurological issues. And so we also prepare extensive information for the neurologists in regard to behavior and seizures and what have you, so that they can also address the individual's needs. And we usually send a staff person or a nurse to those meetings.
Other questions? Thank you. Next program is DSC's Community First.
I wanted to support staff too because Ron had one. Can I go back to a previous application, actually two of them, and make a comment? When Sarah was talking about the hours for apartment services, I counted 7 people just off the top of my head that we support in employment services who get apartment services, and they work evenings and weekends, so their availability is actually more during the day. And I'm sure there are more, but that's all the names I could remember at one point. And then also on the community employment, one of the big pieces we've added is the supported employment. And, you know, we know that we have people that are always going to need that one-on-one support. Laura has some people, and also through Carl, we will have at least 1 to 2 people who will be able to work there on an ongoing basis. And we'll have a staff person working with them. And we're developing short-term employment opportunities. So if businesses call us and say, we've got this job for 2 to 3 months, you know, we've pulled together a group of people, and that's another good way for them, you know, to kind of step out there with a staff person and a couple of their peers and have short-time work opportunities. So for Community First, this is the community groups that depart from Clark Road, or we meet people in the community. We have had to date 50 different topics or subject offerings, and these are based on what people are interested in learning about or doing. They've ranged everything from bowling, swimming at the YMCA, learning how to cook, learning about horses, participating in geocaching. Some of the really remarkable ones, the art groups, the people who really learned
how to express themselves artistically. There was a comment earlier about music and how helpful that was to the people involved in the drumming circle. We actually have a staff person who unfortunately we probably won't be able to keep her for years and years. She's taking a break from getting her PhD in music, and she has worked with a group of people, and they're actually doing a performance at the Crow on Monday or Tuesday, and to see people blossom is remarkable. She's also the one doing the literacy group where we're working with Parkland College. So just a wide variety of opportunities for people. And then we also really tie this in with community employment. So we're helping people with volunteer opportunities. We've got Job Club. And then transportation to and from a job is one of the most critical elements of being employed. And so we have groups of people learning how to navigate the community on the MTD.
Questions?
I also wanted to, hi,
oh,
I'm Laura.
Sorry.
That's okay. I'm sorry, Laura Bennett. I'm the Director of Community Day Services, so also serve a portion of people that you guys fund. And I think the emphasis for our part of the program is on volunteering. I wanted to make you guys aware of just the wide range of volunteer opportunities that people that you support are involved in. We have people working at the crisis, or volunteering at the crisis nursery, at CU Rehab, working with older individuals, people at PACA, at Habitat for Humanity, at Eden Supportive Living Center, Salvation Army, the Vineyard Food Pantry, Salt and Light. So we have a number of volunteer opportunities that people that you support are involved in. The other component is that many of the people in my part of the day services have some pretty significant needs, and they are still very active in their community. And so I wanted you guys to be aware of just how involved people who have some pretty significant either behavioral or medical challenges are part of their community, and you are in part responsible for that. A couple of fun things that people have done recently. This past quarter, individuals went to a couple of the wheelchair basketball tournaments on the U of I campus. Also had some individuals go to the Cardinals caravan. Boo. and then also people enjoyed a jazz concert at Springer Rec Center and some yoga at Cranert, if I can speak. And just getting out and about and participating in things that they find of interest. And so I just wanted you guys to be aware of that.
Thank you. For me personally, when I look at this program, I think you could tell us about outcomes that's measurable, the numbers of people, the percentage of people, who, you know, that would be, it would give us so much more information about some of the things that you're telling us today, but in a more objective, definable way. So I would really appreciate some of that information about outcomes, mm-hmm. personally.
We can definitely do that. And to me, what's even more important about this program than those black and white numbers, It's the individual stories, and it's the people whose lives truly have changed. And I know that sounds dramatic, but, you know, we have a young man who comes just for groups. And the first 30 to 45 minutes that he would come, we would be really dealing with emotional crises. And now he comes in, and he's one of the people who says, this is the direction I want this group to go in. There, you know, I'm not saying that there aren't those moments still, but he's developed coping skills. It's seeing people who, really wouldn't step away from Clark Road now saying, there are 7 groups that I'm interested in, and I know there's not enough time in the week to do everything I want to do. And, you know, those are the things that aren't measurable, but are absolutely.
Well, but you know what? I think they are measurable to an extent. I think that if you can build goals that specifically address the number of individuals who are really struggling behaviorally, and of those numbers, how many that have tried something like this, how many of them have you seen a remarkable difference in in coping skills? I think it's very measurable to kind of get those, and really important to kind of understand the numbers of success stories. There just seems to be like there's a whole lot more information that would help us understand those success stories.
I agree that the personal stories are much more powerful, but this is a public tax board, public tax fund, which as recently as this morning was under attack. So, I mean, I'm sort of always fending little threats to the fund. You're getting too much money. You're not serving enough people. That is the constant refrain. It comes from all sorts of places. It came from some powerful attorneys this morning. So the numbers actually do matter a lot. Being able to demonstrate that we're really aligning with statute and with the priorities and goals that the board has set is really important too. And I actually think there's a way to use the people's stories in that effort, and that those are more compelling than numbers, but they have to be made publicly available and to some extent, right. I mean, this is
quantify and qualify.
This is an existential issue for me. I mean, the fund is always being questioned. So the more we can do with documentation of measures, the better. And if those are supported with powerful personal stories, I love it even more.
And I'm sorry, I hope I didn't sound like I was being negative about the numbers, because people who know me know that I'm kind of a numbers person. I'm that black and white. So I will figure out a way to build in those stories with the numbers.
Well, I think the other component is just recognizing the effect that the Community First program has for families. While some of the people in Annette's program participate solely in groups and are also there, you know, full time, the majority of people that you support in my part of Community First are at DSC every day and are in the community a portion of that time. But you know, to have somebody who has pretty significant needs being supported in a day program 5 days a week is very, very important to families. And that is something that your funding allows to happen. You know, people who do not have state funding can still have a day program and still, you know, have the support that they need based on their medical or behavioral challenges. So that is something that's very important and is, you know, quite measurable also.
Thank you. I think that's exactly right, that you can very easily say of, just throwing numbers out there, of 17 families whose son, daughter, guardian was involved in blah, 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 so many have, this percentage have reported these types of improvements or see value of some sort in this. It would be really helpful for us to see that.
Or families who have maintained their own employment because of this.
Right, and across programs, really, it's so important to build these kinds of measures, you know. Thank you.
Actually, I think that is a pretty meaningful measure for families to be able to maintain their employment.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, next up, DSC Individual and Family Support. Welcome back, Ron.
Hello again.
Hi.
Individual and Family Support Program is might be my favorite part of my job. We serve individuals with quite significant behavioral medical issues and young people who really don't get out in the community that much. And the focus of our program is pretty much to immerse them in the community. All the way back to the beginning of this program, we've heard from families that it's difficult to have family outings, family dinners, what have you, because their son or daughter can't stay still, can't stay seated, does possibly inappropriate things at restaurants or what have you. They want to go to a sibling's sister's softball game, but somebody has to stay home with the person with the intellectual disability. So from the beginning, our hope is to get people out, and so they are more comfortable in the community. And when they're more comfortable in the community, they mix in and they actually communicate, associate with others in the community. And this is the thrust of our program. We do other things. We have volunteer opportunities. We have a group that goes and small group that goes and cleans a church here in Urbana. And we have a young man who works at a restaurant that we support. He works a couple days a week. We try to find new and creative things to do. We travel quite a bit. We go to different activities here in the Champaign County area, as well as one-day trips to Indianapolis, Chicago, to try to expose our individuals to things that families usually experience. A museum in Chicago, a zoo in Indianapolis, some kind of drive-through zoo down by Mattoon or something, I guess the individuals really like, because they have like camels and things like that, and they just love it. Here in town, we participate in the Y and different opportunities here. We might go to Krannert for a brown bag concert over lunch. Whatever we can think of, we have people with specific interests, such as music and art. They share their talents with our young folks and adults. So that's pretty much the program. That's the day program. The other aspects of the program include respite, which is, in my mind, critical to families. I think respite in this community is lacking. We have more individuals needing respite than at this point we can serve. So we've started for the first time in the program a waiting list, which was really hard for me to do last year. At the beginning of the fiscal year, I had to reduce families' respite allocations so we could serve more folks, but we still didn't have enough money to meet all the needs, so we have a small waiting list for the first time. Another critical part of that respite aspect is funding, helping to fund camps. There's a camp outside of Bloomington that's a four-day camp. They sleep overnight in cabins, and I'm amazed at the staff support that's provided there. We have some very challenging individuals who go to these camps, and they do really well. And for parents to have 4 days to themselves and 4 days to focus on the rest of the family is just such an incredible component of respite. Then, of course, there's camps here in town, CUSR. They're fantastic. We help support some Y activity. So the respite aspect of that program is, I think, critical to families. And I know we've applied at DSC for a DHS-funded respite. I hope that works out as well. Questions?
Yeah, Ron, how many of the individuals who receive services through this program also receive supports through other DSC programs? What percentage would you say?
maybe 25%. I mean, I'm just, I know Laura serves an individual who, the same individual who works in a restaurant in the community that we support. He needs one-on-one support at the job, and Laura's program isn't able to provide that. We have other folks who might get some support in the day program, but it's really our, a lot of the folks who we serve in the day program have been, needed too much support to participate in Laura's program, and that's why they came to us. We have a greater need in that program for the waiting list for that program is somewhat more lengthy, and that's because in the day program, most of the individuals are require one-on-one support or one staff member to two individuals. So to expand the number of individuals is difficult.
I guess where I'm going with my questions is that I think about this, obviously, programs that provide these types of services are very near and dear to my heart, just on a, you know, personally. And I think some of these services can be invaluable to individuals and their families. There's a big need. And I'm wondering about linkage, about how, for example, when somebody that's it's being involved in development of a person-centered plan through RPC is aged out of school services, they've transitioned into adult services, they're on a wait list for long-term supports, possibly for employment and housing, and they're sitting at home with mom and dad with nothing to do. This type of a program seems like it'd be something very important to give those people some quality of life while they're waitlisted for other things.
And we have
so it's really, I think, important.
We have situations where it was down to the last couple of weeks before either a mother or father was going to have to quit their job, one of them, to stay home, and we were able to squeeze a person in. And that situation comes up quite a bit. We had a mom working at the U of I who, you know, was a single mom, had a daughter with significant issues, behavioral issues, and we were able to serve her and continue to. Mom is now retired, so she might end up spending more time with her daughter and not have to be at the day program every day when we're discussing those options right now. But we wish we did have more capacity.
Jumping all over board member time. Just, I appreciate, we had a discussion with you all many months ago about respite, and it was very helpful to me to see there really is a difference between respite and this program. Like, it would be really great to have both. I think if you know, in the event that you don't get the state funding to do respite, I would really not want to see the pressure for that be taken up by this program, because they are really different. And I don't know, do you have any kind of backup plan like that? It's almost a question of how could you expand capacity for this program, but it really is more how do you protect this program from the continuing absence of simple respite.
Oh, yeah. And again, the need for the types of supports we provide, the one-on-one, are mounting, and we aren't able to expand to that. I don't know that I could. It was difficult enough to start a waiting list in respite, so I don't know that we could take money from that part of the program to put into the day program, because the respite needs continue to grow as well. And the other issue with this program is movement. You know, these individuals that we serve, most of them aren't going to go out and get a half-time job. their parents and families rely on this program.
So, and if I could interject, and I'm sorry to do that, but to me, the respite piece of it almost seems incidental, because of the vast majority of situations, the ability to involve these individuals in activities that they enjoy, camps or whatever in the community, is providing respite for their family, right? I mean, am I wrong about that? Am I missing something?
Well, you have addressed the same issue that respite addresses traditionally, and that's with camps or vouchers or, you know, sort of the brief, the temporary stuff. But the other part of IFS, where you don't serve very many people and they don't move along very quickly, seems really important. And it can't grow if the other need is growing. The need for short term is also growing. And home-based support is one place where, you know, people have gotten home-based support awards and left this program to make use of those awards or SILA awards. But, you know, that's not happening with lightning speed either. So,
Well, a lot of the folks in respite are kids, too. I mean, they go to school, but families still need a break. You know, in the summer, our busy times are in June when there's no summer school, or over the holidays when families are trying to provide and plan for their holidays for their whole family. And so it really helps them to have some respite during the Christmas season, June, when there's no school, summer school or anything else. So that's where primarily respite is for kids. There aren't that many adults in respite, and especially adults who come to our day program. They don't participate in respite. So they are kind of getting their respite during the day, and then young school-age kids are getting their respite at night, or the family is.
I just wanted to speak to, I mean, when Ron kind of initiated this program many years ago, this really is blending two very unique services, and one is probably the most expensive service that we provide, and one is the most inexpensive service that we provide, but both are detrimental to the families. So in terms of a backup plan, it would just be a bigger ask at some point, and that would be at the expense of something else, and, you know, we'd have to prioritize. But if the respite comes through, if we do receive the grant, I mean, one of the things that we would evaluate is primarily the people that are currently receiving respite funded by TDP would be the first ones to access the state-funded respite. We owe that to the board, and that's our priority too. And so that would free up some IFS funding, and we would have to really look at, is there still a gap in respite, or have we satisfied that, and would that mean there might be a few more people that could be served in the IFS side of the program? But again, it depends on, you know, I don't know, they didn't ask what we would do if we got partial funding, so I think it's probably all or nothing. But so, you know, a month from now, we'll really be able to evaluate what the impact of that may be on next fiscal year. Absolutely. I got some really great letters from people in this room to support that request. So.
Okay. Thank you. PACE is next, I believe. Personal support.
Okay. also for the personal support workers. Yep, definitely sounds different. Also for the personal support workers, we work with them. We offer spaces for them to interview. We talk with them about the experiences they've had that kind of lend themselves to this work. And we also kind of give them resources on different trainings which might help make them more employable. So that's really what you guys are supporting with this program.
Okay, thank you. Jermaine, how many personal support workers have been trained in this past fiscal year for with DDB monies?
Yeah, so currently the registry is up to 20. We had some staff things in the first quarter, so we kind of changed kind of the organization around a little bit and brought somebody in the middle of Q2, and we had to build everything from scratch kind of. And so really we've gotten up and running as of really December and January is when we really got up and running. And since then we've got 20 people oriented as of the end of last week. And so far, three of them have found jobs as personal support workers. And we think we have a match from last week. It's not final lockdown, so we think that's up to four. So,
when you say 20 oriented, so did you say there's 20 completely trained?
20 who are oriented on our registry, who when somebody – so the process is when somebody I guess to give you the other half of the program that we're kind of doing with other funds we get. When a family comes to us looking for a personal support worker, what we do is we go through the list. We sit down with them and we have what we call kind of a consumer seeking personal assistant or personal support worker form. And it kind of outlines kind of the hours they're looking for and the services they're looking for and kind of some preferences, so such as like hobbies, because we want to try to make as good a match as we can. And so we sit down with the families or the individuals looking for personal support workers, and we get them names of personal support workers who have been through our orientation, who we've completed the paperwork with them that allows us to have all that information. And so, yes, currently we have 20 people on our registry who have completed the orientation, who are completely up to date, who we have all that paperwork to make all those matches happen.
And of those, out of those 20 personal support workers, three of them have been matched with individuals.
Yes, and okay. Like I said, we have another one that it looks like is probably a match from last week, so... right now, it looks like about 25%. No, 20%. Sorry, math is not good this early in the morning.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Thank you, Jermaine. Champaign County Head Start.
Good morning. I'm Brandy Granz, the Early Childhood Division Director for Champaign County Regional Planning Commission.
And I'm Elise Belknap. I'm the Social Emotional Development Specialist for Champaign County Head Start.
To provide you with an overview for our application, just a little bit of information about our program. The RPC Early Childhood Education Program, also known as Champaign County Head Start, Early Head Start, we're currently in the process of transitioning, provides comprehensive services to pregnant women, teens, and children birth to 5 years of age and their families who have financial and life needs such as housing, food, and employment needs. The comprehensive services include education, health, nutrition, dental, and family support. We currently serve 435 preschoolers, 141 infants, toddlers, and pregnant women and teens. Recently, our program was awarded 90 additional enrollments of infants, toddlers, and pregnant women and teens to serve those families residing in the Champaign area. Our program has four centers throughout Champaign County. We also provide home-based services and have six collaborations with family child care providers and a collaboration with Courage Connection. The proposed application is to continue providing intervention services to children who have social-emotional needs and developmental delays. Our goal is to ensure children are developmentally and health ready for kindergarten and ensuring our families are ready to support their child in school. The application requests full support to fund the social emotional development specialist who identifies and creates individual plans and activities for children in the classroom, makes referrals to local providers for evaluations and therapy, and also provides training and support to staff and families, as well as supervising the social skills and prevention coaches who work in the classroom on a daily basis. We are open to any questions that you might have.
It seems like there's a large number of anticipated clients compared to previous numbers, and that goes along with the increase in funding that you're requesting. Can you explain me why that is?
So in terms of, so we're seeing an increase in the number of people that we're serving, and that can fluctuate from year to year, but with the new social skills and prevention coaches who are actually on site every day versus there being one me for all four sites, we're seeing an increase in the number of children we're actually getting to serve, right? And we are... we're also with this new grant that we've been able to acquire for the new EHS students. We're going to be able to serve more students there as well. That makes sense.
I think so.
Any other questions?
I had one other question. Do you have any interactions with Crisis Nursery, which I expect would be a source of referrals to your program? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's typically the flow, is that so we have family advocates that work with every enrolled family at our sites, and they are, they're funded not through this grant, but their role is to connect our families to whatever services they need in the community. And Crisis Nursery is sometimes one of those services, but that being a crisis service, their goal is often to find permanent child care for the families that they work with, and that is often us, right? So we have quite a bit of communication with them.
The other thing I wanted to ask was with the ages and stages questionnaire, it seems like that's something that's used a lot in physician offices for screening mm-hmm. of young children. Mm-hmm. How many referrals do you get directly from physician offices of people who aren't in your program already, just out of interest?
Unfortunately, we don't see a whole lot of referrals coming from the medical clinics here.
Why do you think that is?
I mean, they will refer families to Head Start, but not based on their developmental screening. We just don't see it as often. And it's also possible that families aren't reporting that directly to us. So that's another reason why that information may be skewed. Mm-hmm.
Did you all talk about what the new grant was for? Yes. You did. I'm sorry. Okay.
Yes, that's
okay. I'll
get
caught up later.
No,
you.
That's okay. Any other questions?
Not from me. No, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
So next, Deb is back just in time. Oh, I'm sorry. So next is family development. Do you call it family development now?
Word, right, that we dropped, but it, yeah. It sounds better, I think. So I am Patty Walters at DSC. Nicole Sikora wasn't able to be here this morning. She will be at the meeting this evening and can speak to this program as well. I wasn't sure. This is the one program that has been funded by the Mental Health Board.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that it'll come up in both venues, but I wasn't sure. Maybe not.
It's the very last thing tonight. So it might, you know, they might not have any questions by then, or okay. It might get put till a later week, or they might not ask at all. So it's really great that you're able to speak to the application this
okay,
morning.
Well, I hope I'm a suitable substitute. I was. So the early intervention program, there's actually three components to family development, and one which is funded by CCDDB, and probably about 86% of the funding, I think, is around the amount that is funded by county funding. And it serves children all over Champaign County. We do have kind of a high presence in rural county areas, which is pretty significant because of access to service. A lot of those families are not in a position to be able to come to town. And all of the services are provided as home visits. So it's a home visiting program with the exception of playgroup, which people come to a location and do activities together with children and parents. So 0 to 6 program, infants, toddlers, and young children. It's age birth to 5 and then through that school transition. And they either have a developmental disability or they are at risk of having one or have a delay of sorts. So when we receive a referral and a screening is completed, the referral then goes to the state for consideration, and there needs to be at least a 30% delay for a child to qualify for state services. So one of the things that has happened over the years is the beauty of the DDB funding is that there's no interruption in service as children begin to progress. So if a child receives state services and they're getting really good early intervention services and they kind of get to that age level where they're supposed to be, then state doesn't want to fund that anymore. And so they start digressing again. And so that county funding is able to support that. It's typically a little cleaner than that. There's not as much going back and forth because they, as we know, change the definition periodically when they don't have enough money to support everything that they're doing. So the program has screening services, which typically happen upon referral or at events. We do participate in a lot of local events, including the Disability Expo, Reading Across America, some private events that are scheduled, like at the Douglas Center and different places, Douglas Library, sorry. Playgroup, there is a playgroup that is offered. There's actually one funded by Champaign County Developmental Disabilities Board and one that is through the Parent Wonders Program, which is funded through ISBE. And that one is in St. Joe. And then Play Project, which is a significant intense therapy service that's done at home with families for children with autism. And the intent is through play therapy to help open up social opportunities and create learning opportunities where the families can connect with the children, and then hopefully those skills are transferable into other settings. They do some screenings and some services in daycare settings. It's to be the least restrictive and is typically the family home, but that's an option. So developmental therapy, speech therapy, comprehensive evaluation, the developmental play groups, parent support groups, play project, and then the child care consultation is another component that is not funded by this board. So you'll see the residency. I mean, there's about 670 close to that served annually. This is a program that sees a significant amount of diversity, and in part because I think those referrals come up from a wide variety of places, including doctors and hospitals and like crisis nursery and different places that you've mentioned with the Head Start application. Catching those children early can mean less costly service, and early intervention is critical to child development and school readiness. So I will entertain questions.
One of the questions that I had is, you know, you listed the developmental and speech and speech therapy services. So many of the kids that I interacted with over the years also required physical and occupational therapy services. How are those covered, if at all, through this?
It is not covered directly through DSC. There is a kind of a global shortage of OT and PT services in the state, not just Champaign County. A lot of independent providers, it used to be really strong in that area, and even that has kind of gone down because of the way that it's funded, and delayed payments and things like that have happened. So, I mean, some of these other therapies actually try to kind of compensate for that a little bit. But it's a need. It is an area of need that isn't well funded and isn't prioritized by the state. So it's a gap in service.
And it seems like there's your anticipated need is 655 participants this year. And in the past, there's been a few more. I mean, those are very small differences in numbers. But is there a drop in the need for these services?
No, I think that, you know, we are preparing applications mid-year, you know, during a fiscal year, and it's based on really kind of the number that you're serving at that mid-year point. And it also is based on the level of support that people need. So if there's a family that might only need, you know, speech therapy one time a week, or, you know, one time every 2 weeks or once a month, that's going to affect the number of people that particular therapist can support. So, you know, when we're doing the application in January and looking at the demographics and who we're supporting, then we make a best guesstimate. I think we surpassed that last year, and we certainly don't have any problem going over the numbers, but we don't want to be, you know, too unrealistic and miss by much. So I think that, you know, we probably will be right on target. But level of intensity matters. If we've got somebody that is getting all the therapies that we offer and the resources are really significantly needed for a particular family, that affects somebody that may have similar needs. So 14 can mean 14 people that are not getting one service, or it can mean 14 people that aren't getting a lot of service. It just, you know, it depends on, you know, exactly what their needs are. And we definitely refer to other programs if needed, and collaborate with a lot of local community agencies. This program in particularly, there's a great collaboration in this community for EI services and early intervention and children's services.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Next up, CU Amel.
Amy Slagle with CU Amel. Our organization is composed of caregivers and other community members that are affected by disabilities. We offer networking opportunities, educational events, and social opportunities to other caregivers and professionals in Champaign County. We have meetings every month that are free to the public, free and open to the public, mostly for family members who want to network and meet other family members, with similar challenges. We have a mom's retreat in the summer that we hold that enables moms or female caregivers to get away for a weekend. So for two nights overnight, all meals are included. And that is something that the DD board funds. And in addition to that, we have a really active Facebook community where parents can kind of get on and ask questions of each other and provide information, other resources, and things like that. And we try to record, like video record meetings and post those on our Facebook page as well. Yeah.
Thank you. Amy, I just have one question. I don't know how you exactly could measure this, but do you think that it would be possible to serve more moms at your mom's retreat, for example, if you had a sliding scale? Or do you feel like you're really reaching the targeted group?
Yeah.
With the full scholarship?
Yeah, the full scholarship, let me think. So scholarships are just basically, we offer them to all Champaign County residents, but also we try to help any other moms who are struggling financially if they request it. And I don't know, we haven't talked about a sliding scale, so that's something to consider.
About your demographic, you know, just how many people you think might be out there that would find value in this versus how many are actually able to participate.
Yeah, I think some of the challenge is also just being able to get away for a weekend and leave their kids. So that's, I think that's more of a challenge than the financial component for moms.
Just, I'm kind of on an outcomes mantra today. I really value for us as board members in understanding the consumer outcome, how the people who are using this money for these services feel about it, what they feel they've gained, what value they find in it, versus just listing what you've done.
Yeah. We have had a lot of testimonials. We put some of them on our website, but I can also, send you some of those as well.
The more objective you can make your data, the better it is, rather than just narrative. You know, that's important too, to us, to understand how people feel about it. But, you know, just a measurable way that we can understand that what percentage or how many people found what type of value in this service.
So are you thinking like an outcome survey of families who are? Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Something along those lines would be really helpful.
Okay. We do understand the limitations of surveys, but they even with the really low rate of return and all the tricks to get people to fill them out, they really do give you about the most to-the-point information when we're looking at what it meant to someone. That's
all right.
It isn't easy though, but we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, Champaign County Down Syndrome Network.
Yep, one more.
We're close to the end, aren't we? Okay. The next community choice is self-determination support.
I'm Becca Obachowski again. Self-determination support, that's what we call this, the grant. The department that it sort of is associated with is our Connect department. And so there's sort of three main areas of focus within this program. And the first of that is community building. And so when we talk about sort of supporting people with disabilities and supporting their family, I think a lot of the language is we say we're going to help people be in the community, but we really want people to be of the community. And so that's both the internal community that we've created as the Human Services Cooperative, but also sort of the broader community sort of out in the world and being connected to people based on shared value and shared interests and sort of you know, the things that bring anybody together. So obviously that's sort of a very existential explanation of the program. But within that community building, we try to have a lot of different sort of entry points. And so sort of that internal community, we offer people opportunities to go out and engage in social opportunities, to do the type of things that other adults in the community do for fun, to kind of both explore and see what's available, to see if something really sparks their interest, but also to connect with each other and potentially to connect with some of those locations. And we also foster connections between families and between, you know, just through positive shared experiences like parties and, you know, meetings and support groups. And the potlucks. So some of the things that generally bring all people together, we try to build those into the program. But we also do sort of more systematic support. So we'll help people, you know, if there's people who want to sort of figure out some more sustained friendships with other folks with disabilities, we can set up what we call co-op clubs. And that's where we work with an individual to sort of be the organizer of a club and find they may have people that they know that they would like to get involved with a particular activity that they want to invite. If they don't know people, we'll also sort of help them find some people who maybe have some shared interests and bring those folks together and really just help them learn the skills that they need in order to reach out and organize dinner with friends or organize going to get a cup of coffee or going to a movie, you know, getting together to play video games. Some of these things that are just like very regular, typical activities, but that people maybe haven't had the opportunity to learn how to do just through the normal evolution of life quite in the same way. Then we also help people get connected to sort of the broader community. So people may come to us and say, like, I'm really interested in being involved in radio. So we may help them kind of start a show on WEFT or through the IMC. Or we had an individual, she really loves, you know, dancing and performing, and we've helped her get involved with the group CLAW, the Champagne Lady Amateur Wrestling Group. So it can really be a wide range of things, and it's a very flexible support system where we'll sort of investigate with the person what's going to be meaningful and help them get connected and build those natural supports so they can kind of become a part of whatever that community is that they've identified they want to be part of. And so then we also provide, so that's the community building piece of it. There's the family support and education piece of it. And this is because just from sitting here, it's very obvious that the disability support system is extremely confusing and can be very overwhelming for parents and individuals trying to access it and use it. And families learn so much about it and learn sort of these tricks and resources. And we want to both help people sort of share share that information between each other, but then also provide information about the overall service system so that they can be good advocates, so that they can understand how to best use their services and how to ask for the services that are going to help make their lives better. So we do that with sort of public informational meetings. We have a family support group that helps families sort of address strategies and issues that you know, the relationship between a parent and their adult child is different than a parent and a younger child. So sort of how do you negotiate that transition and what are some good strategies for helping both people sort of grow into that new dynamic. And then we also provide opportunities for people to sort of build leadership skills and to then live those leadership skills out in specific projects. So some of those have been the mentoring program where we've partnered with U One-to-One Mentoring to help have folks with disabilities go into schools and be mentors for young people with disabilities to show them, you know, like, hey, you can be a leader and also be somebody who has a disability. We've also done a lot of work around healthcare advocacy and sort of developing some guides and are hoping to expand some of that work with some additional funding that I have talked to you guys about before. So in a nutshell, I think that's kind of, there's always a lot of pieces to that program. So I'm happy to answer questions about more specifics. May 9th. Yes, I will absolutely let you know.
Questions? Any questions? Wow, I just realized we're down to two.
And actually, if okay. I could just add, if I could add one thing really quickly to it, I think I've heard you mention the importance of outcome information and evaluation. This program was actually able to be part of the Mental Health Board's evaluation capacity building project a couple years ago, and it was hugely helpful in allowing us to identify some outcomes related to these very broad areas of support. And when you talk about how do you identify, like, if somebody has community in their life or if somebody, feels connected, figuring out a very empirical way to measure that is really difficult. And I think that they were helpful in getting us going on that path. I think we still have a ways that we could go, as well as I'm sure a lot of the programs in the room could too. So I thought that was a hugely helpful resource that the board was able to offer at that time. So just kind of to speak to your emphasis on it.
I just think it's extremely important and really helpful for us in helping to determine how people are benefiting from this money. So I really appreciated this good data. Thank you.
It's strange, and it's taken me some getting used to that. We have to tell the story of this fund in a really different way than the work is actually done. Mm-hmm. And the work shouldn't be done in this way, because this is a public story and the work is personal. So it's been very hard for me to adjust to that reality too.
We're talking about a county full of individuals, you know what I mean? So personal narratives are really helpful but there's really no other way to get an understanding, I don't think, of how many people or what percentage are really benefiting in a certain way without having those outcomes. Thank you.
Thanks.
Jermaine Pace, Opportunities for Independence.
So the Opportunities for Independence program, a couple of years ago, we took a different direction for this program, and we, through collaborations with Lynn and some board members at the time, we kind of made a change, and we started going into schools to provide independent living and self-advocacy focused peer support groups, trainings to students primarily with developmental disabilities in rural Champaign County. And so in this program, we supplement what the schools do. We are very careful not to supplant educational funds and those requirements that they are to complete. So typically the way educational institutions tend to look at independent living is through the development of kind of more hard skills such as laundry, housekeeping, cooking. We really focus on, self-advocacy and, learning how to access resources, kind of those other skills related to when to disclose your disability, how to disclose your disability, what is a reasonable accommodation, those things that often aren't taught. So it tends to be a focus on different skills than what is often focused on in standard independent living curriculums. And so currently we are in two Champaign County schools. We are looking, we're always looking to expand into other schools, and we work closely with the rural Champaign County Special Ed Cooperative. I always mix up those words. To try to network to get into additional schools. So that is kind of the primary focus. We do have a few consumers who we work with in our office on everything from kind of employment skills development, such as learning how to write resumes and those kind of things, to even throughout the years is, you know, learning how to count money. So independent living skills in general. So the primary focus in the last couple of years has definitely become the school trainings, but we still do also serve some consumers in the office as well. Any questions?
I guess my only question would be, you're working with rural Champaign County schools, that long acronym. Anyway, but you're only in two schools right now.
Currently, yes.
Is there movement towards getting into other schools?
Yeah, so we're throughout the school year, we might not so for instance, one thing we've done this year is we might not be necessarily in Mahomet Seymour, but we might be working with the Mahomet area Macy to offer services in the Mahomet area. That's some outreach we are really trying to hit hard to try to get into the Mahomet area. One of the schools we used to have, we lost because the teacher who kind of championed it moved on out of county, I think to Tuscola. So we kind of lost that kind of connection to that school. So we are working closely to try to build that back up.
Thank you, Jermaine.
Thank you.
And finally, community choices, community living.
So our community living program, the bulk of this program is our community transitional support piece. And this program focuses on supporting individuals who are interested in general, moving out of their family home into their own apartment or house. We do occasionally work with people who are interested in moving, you know, from a more supported living arrangement to something that is more kind of on their own. So we're working with somebody who lives at Eden, for example, and she's looking to move out and live just in any old apartment in the community. So, but in general, it does focus on folks who are leaving their family home. It's a phase-based process. So we spend about 6 months working with the individual and their family to identify kind of what sort of housing is available, to organize, like, you know, the financial aspect of it, to do sort of assessment of where their, you know, their skills are, what areas are they going to need additional support or some additional training in order to be sort of independent and sustainable. Once they move out, we spend the next year sort of really working on the those particular areas of those real concrete skills. So getting to the grocery store, making sure that the home is, you know, clean and well cared for, cooking, transportation, just kind of those, you know, everyday sort of daily living skills. And then once they are sort of getting a good handle on that, the focus shifts on sort of building connections with people in the community, with organizations, with activities. That's going to be really individualized as to what that looks like for the person. But really sort of identifying that to be happy and successful in the community, you need more than just somewhere to live. You also need to be connected so that you're not just sitting at home by yourself. So sort of building in that ongoing support. And then once the person is doing well and sort of stable and sustaining in that living arrangement, we will fade back and can be available for sort of ongoing consultation, you know, if something comes up. The other aspect of the program is mostly funded through the state, which is self-direction assistance through the home-based support program. So we, with that, we also have a PSW database that that families can access who use that program or who are members of the cooperative. And we also then have personal development or life skills classes that we offer that are available to anybody. So you don't have to be part of the community transitional support. It's open to anybody who's involved in the organization. So just as another entry point, so people can just sign up for that. They don't have to wait as long as there's a class open. We've had
two safety classes, so one that was more safety based in the home, one that was more safety in the community. We had a sexuality education and a healthy relationships class that we partnered with RACES and Urbana Public Health, or Champaign-Urbana Public Health, to do that. And then in general, we sort of support people who are looking for alternative housing arrangements, so helping people find supportive roommates or community builders to live with them if that's a support need, getting families hooked up together to sort of share information about how to use resources and you know, pooling things together and roommate matching and that kind of thing as well too when it comes up. Any questions?
I have no questions, Dr. Kennedy.
Okay.
Thank you, Becca. And that brings us to a close, this part of the agenda. Thank you all. Okay, under new business, item B, board direction. I see we have a handout here, but this is... Okay, did you want to do that now or should we...
The handout that I gave to everyone is from... It's from Touch of Nature Camp in Carbondale, and they approached all the 708 and 377 boards in the state asking to... just for like straight up money to support campers. But I think since the way we contract with some of you is that you can identify support for somebody who can't afford it and wants to do something like this. Not all of the contracts do that, but some do. So I thought maybe you should just have this resource and you can contact them and then tell us if it was great or like we should never mention it again. I mean, she was lovely to talk to, but it's an odd way to do it since we're all of us have to be very careful about our counties or townships. So anyway, it's a resource if you have someone who wants it.
Thank you. Okay, C, successes and other agency information.
So I just wanted to let you guys know about an event that we are planning in partnership with the Urbana Park District in Bi-Urbana and 25 O'Clock Brewery. So we are hosting an unconference this June, June 7th and 8th. And so it's an opportunity for people with disabilities to be leaders and just it's an open source event. So it's a conference that is the sessions are not planned until people arrive and volunteer to lead them. And so we're going to be working with some people to kind of have a few plants in the audience to make sure some things happen. But we build the calendar on Friday night as part of First Fridays, and it will be on Saturday afternoon at 3 locations. So there'll be more information about that coming up. But our hope is that it'll be a fully inclusive opportunity for people with disabilities and just anybody in the community to come together and sort of learn from each other in a very open and democratic way, and to be able to see all people as having value and having something to contribute to the broader community. So please come.
Thank you. Okay, under old business, meeting schedules are included on pages 112 to 114. Looking ahead at MHB, we don't have an MHB board member here. Mark's here, and I think there's a study session tonight.
The tonight's meeting is similar to the conversation we've just had here this morning. We're reviewing a set of applications this evening. It's on system of care, our system of care priorities, a few renewals, and then two IDDD applications, which you've heard from already this morning.
Thank you, Mark. I have no announcements. Does anybody else have anything to announce? Nope. We are adjourned. Thank you all very much.